குட் மார்னிங் ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் அப்பா தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதார விந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய வெப் மீட்டிங் நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இன்று கேரி சார் அவர்களும் மிஸ்டர் சந்திரசேகர் அவர்களும் டிவைன் லைஃப் என்ற டாபிக் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். நவ் ஐ ஆம் இன்வைட்டிங் கேரி சார் டு ஸ்டார்ட் தி டாபிக்.
குட் மார்னிங். We come to the last chapter, 56. That means when we start this chapter, we have already read and discussed 1,014 pages, 55 pages left. What more can he tell us after reading 1,000 pages and 56 chapters? Is there anything left to say? First time and second time I read this chapter, I was thinking, oh, life divine means it's so far away. We've gone to ascending series, we've gone to the ascent, we've gone through the ignorance, we've gone through the evolution, we've gone from higher mind to illumined mind to intuitive mind to over mind, ascent to super mind. Now he's going to life divine. I think it can wait. I can wait till I do something in the earlier chapters. This is too much. Life divine is so far away. And yet, when we read this chapter, in one sense, I think this is the most intimate chapter, personally relevant to all of us. Gives a message so direct, so simple, though he takes 55 pages to do it. The message is so simple, so clear, and so direct, without a lot of philosophy and all. That it seems like a personal message that he wrote to everybody. Maybe at the end of writing all the other chapters, remember, he wrote this one chapter every month. And so he had time to get feedback and questions from everybody over a period of almost 5 years. In fact, this chapter was written much later than the others. So I thought maybe after writing 55 chapters and hearing the questions that people are asking and all, he said, maybe I better start at a more basic level. In one sense, I thought this chapter could have been the first chapter. What he says here, he could have written this first because it's so basic but so important. So he starts with the fundamental theme of the whole book, and that is, there is a self-existent reality that has become the universe. It doesn't matter what we call it, whether we call it Brahman, or we call it the Absolute, or we call it Satchitananda, or we call it the Divine, all of those words have a significance. The truth, but fundamentally, he says, there is a self-existent reality which is infinite and eternal, and most importantly, relevantly for us, it's conscious. It's not the self-existent material reality like the marble floor that's going to be here for thousands or millions of years. It's a conscious reality. And he says, it's a being. This reality is a being. It's not a thing. It's not just a big space. It's not just a lot of matter. It is a conscious being. And that is the origin of the universe. And then he tells us something else that's very important, because when we look at the universe, we don't see a self-existent reality. I don't know if you do. I don't. We don't see the being. We don't see the consciousness. What we see is a material existence with some living forms and a few thinking animal species in it. So it raises a question: if the self-existent reality has become the universe, what is this self-existent reality? What we see doesn't look infinite, doesn't look eternal. Then he tells us a very important thing that the tradition has missed. Being is becoming. This universe is not the being. This is the becoming of that being. Meaning, this universe is a progressive manifestation and evolution of that self-existent reality. And we cannot tell what the future of the universe can be by looking back at the past. We can get some hints, he tells us, but fundamentally we cannot judge the reality from what we see around us or what has happened before. If we really want to understand the meaning of the universe, we have to look very carefully and perceptively for the hints and secrets of what's revealing itself. And there he says, when you do that, it's very obvious. It's the evidence is right there before us. Because this universe began as a completely inconscient material existence, a force, building up matter, building up material forms. And that was all there was for billions of years. And then a couple of billion years ago, suddenly life sprouted on this universe, at least on this planet. We don't know about anywhere else. And over a course of a billion years, millions of life forms sprouted, different types of species, vegetable species, animal species. Finally, after so many millions and millions of years, in the last 100,000 million years, depending on how you count it, man, humans appeared, who are not just a life form, but they're a thinking life form, a conscious life form. So he says, if you want a hint from what the world is, what it's going to become, you have to understand something is emerging that was hidden. What is that thing that's emerging? It's something alive. It's not just a material existence. It's something conscious. So he says, consciousness and life are the key words that are the secrets to the universe. Not matter. Matter is there. Matter is only the beginning. You can't judge the future from the beginning. You have to understand that this universe is a progressive manifestation of consciousness and life. And so he tells us, well, what is consciousness as we know it? What is the consciousness that has emerged in the universe that we have learned about? We know consciousness as mind. For us, consciousness is our capacity to think, our capacity to feel, our capacity to reason, to judge, to communicate, to invent, to organize. That's mental consciousness. But he says very importantly, when we look at the mental consciousness, it's very obvious to us, this is not really consciousness. This is not pure consciousness. This is only an imperfect little expression of consciousness. If there is an infinite self-existent reality that is manifesting and becoming in the universe, consciousness that we know is not the end of the story. Just like matter was not the end of the story, what mind is not the end of the story. There have been earlier stages of consciousness before man. We have the ape, we have all the mammals, we have all the animals, we have the plants. All of them have characteristics of consciousness, of which ours is the highest. But our consciousness is very imperfect. As we've discussed, we are ignorant in so many different ways. He says seven ways. But fundamentally, we're ignorant of everything. We don't know what to do the next minute. We don't know who we are. We don't know our own mind, vital and physical. We don't know our psychic. We don't know the world around us. We don't know the transcendent. We don't know our infinite, eternal soul beyond the universe. We don't know the absolute reality. This consciousness that we know is not the end of the evolution of consciousness. This is not consciousness, which a big C, which is the consciousness of that self-existent reality. This is only a small part. This is the beginning of the story. This is like Darcy meets seeing Elizabeth for the first time and calling her tolerable. What does he know about Elizabeth at that time? He only knows an external appearance. He says, if this world is a manifestation of a self-existent infinite consciousness, that consciousness must be perfect. And what would a conscious, perfect consciousness be? First of all, it would know itself completely. And what is itself? The reality of that consciousness is it's infinite and eternal. How many of us know that we're infinite and eternal? That means fundamentally we have not developed and discovered the power of consciousness that created us. We have mistaken our present consciousness for the reality. It's not. It's not the reality of the divine. It's not the reality of ourselves. It's only a limited instrument. We're at the beginning of the story. If a perfect infinite consciousness would not only know that we are infinite and eternal, it would know that everybody else is infinite and eternal. It would know the divine soul of every other person we meet. Count on with your fingers how many people you have discovered their soul. How many people, when you relate to them, you're relating to the divine in other people. He says a perfect consciousness would know that the whole cosmos, the whole universe, the whole earth is divine. How many of you wake up in the morning, every morning, feeling I'm living in the divine? I'm walking on the divine. I'm breathing the divine. The whole world, I am in heaven. The whole world is divine. That's what a perfect consciousness would know. Our problem is not with the world. We think our problem is with other people. They don't understand us and they don't do the right thing. Our problem is with our consciousness. We are not conscious. Our consciousness is so limited and imperfect. And if we really had discovered that perfect consciousness, we would know the world is a very small place. The whole universe is a very small place. The cosmos is a small place. Our real existence goes beyond the universe. The divine, the self-existent reality that is expressing in the universe is infinitely greater than the universe. What is the difference between where we are and the reality that we have to discover? My analogy is, can Darcy, at the beginning of the story, when he sees Elizabeth, he calls her tolerable. Can he imagine? This is my soulmate. This is what I was born for. I was born to win this woman, and I'd be so happy. My life will be a heaven on earth if I can marry Elizabeth. But he has to go further than that, because Even when he thinks of proposing to Elizabeth, he somehow wants to take Elizabeth away and forget about Mrs. Bennet and forget about Lydia, and certainly he never wants to hear the name Wickham again in his life. How to tell Darcy it's not enough on that first day. It's not enough that you discover the soul in Elizabeth and want her. You have to discover the soul in Lydia, in Mrs. Bennet, and even in that devilish man, Wickham. You have to see that everything happens to you is an expression of the divine. Then we would say Darcy's conscious. Not enough. Even if Darcy knows that every character, every person he knows in the story is really himself, a soul like himself, part of himself, he doesn't know the truth. The truth that we know is that the real creator of the story is Jane Austen. And the real reality of Darcy is Jane Austen. If Darcy should really know himself, he should know that the truth of his being is Jane Austen, not Darcy Fitzwilliam, not the husband of Lizzie. That he's the creator of the whole universe. And having created and become the universe, he has also become a soul in that universe, living as a character in that universe. The whole creation is him. And he's existing beyond that. That is what he would, Sri Aurobindo calls perfect consciousness. That is our destiny. That is what we, when we achieve that perfect consciousness, that is what we will know. We are not just an individual here. We are not just a divine soul. We are not just living with other souls who are also ourselves. We are an expression and an incarnation of the Ishvara, of the infinite and eternal that's created the universe. Until then, we are not conscious. We are only living on a thin, superficial shadow of consciousness. So when he talks about Gnostic life, divine life, supermental consciousness, not, this is what he's talking about. This is the becoming of that self-existent reality. It's not going to stop until each of us becomes conscious of the fact that that's the truth of our being. That's what the world is here for. That is our destiny. He said, our destiny is not a human destiny, because in the process of this, we're going to outgrow even humanity. We will cease to be human in our consciousness. Whatever we look like, whatever we talk or behave or anything, we will be transcend. Human consciousness is mental consciousness, meaning it's unconsciousness, meaning it's ignorance, meaning it's ego. We are not even limited by humanity, any more than humanity was limited by the ape or anything that came before that. That is our destiny. That is the destiny of the universe, particularly the earth. So the becoming of the self-existent reality is to achieve a perfect consciousness. That's the first key word. He said the second key word, secret of this existence, is life. Life. What do we know as life? The life as we know it is definitely not the perfect life of a perfect, eternal, and infinite self-existent consciousness. We have suffering, we have pain, we have limitation. We can do a few things, we can't do many other things, we can't do anything we want to do. We're subject to death. We've got a few years and the whole thing is over. So this is not the life that he's talking about. this is only a small shadow of the life. When he talks about a divine life, he's talking about life with a capital L, like the consciousness with a capital C. What is that life? It's a life of total freedom. There is nothing but freedom. There is nothing that can constrain you, nothing that can constrict you, nothing that can limit you. There is nothing that you cannot do. As Krishna said in the Gita, you can become anything you want to become. That is life with a capital L. There is no death because you are the immortal. You're not only immortal as a soul that's going to get reborn over and over and over again. Death itself, you need not accept it. That's what Savitri has come for, to defeat death. That is the life with a capital L. And he says, consciousness is evolving. Life is evolving by the evolution of consciousness. Consciousness is evolving by the organization of life. The two go together. Our life is developing because we're becoming more conscious. Our consciousness is gaining power because of the life that we have developed outside. Consciousness gives us the knowledge, the expression of that consciousness, the power to make it real in the world, is what he's calling life. They go together. So if we want a divine life, it's obvious that we can never have a divine life until we achieve a divine consciousness. Humanity today is trying to reach a perfect life. If not perfect, at least much better than it was before. We're trying to eradicate diseases, we're trying to eradicate war, we're trying to eliminate famine and poverty and mosquitoes and so many other things so that everybody has more and more and more. The God we believe in is science. The God we believe in is technology. We think about getting more university degrees is going to make life perfect. As long as our consciousness is imperfect, life can never be perfect. A perfect life means a life of complete harmony. You remember in chapter 1, page 2, he says that very mysterious thing. It was very mysterious to me when I read it the first 10, 20 times. All problems of life are problems of harmony. All problems of life? I mean, Darcy's problems are definitely a problems of harmony. Mrs. Bennett's problems, they're definitely problems of all problems of life. But now by the end of the book, we understand all our problems of life originate because we think we're separate from everybody else. Not only we feel we're separate from everybody else, but we have an urge, an irresistible urge, I must be important. Other people should do what I want. Other people should help me, serve me, at least adjust with me, at least give me what I want. Because we live not only in a mental consciousness, we live in an egoistic consciousness, which can never be fully harmonious with anybody, except if everybody will do what I say. Just listen and do what I say and agree with everything and shake my head, and then everything, my life will be divine, but everybody else's life will be hell. That's because the mental consciousness cannot create that harmony. The ego cannot create that harmony. He says, We become ourselves by knowing ourselves. We become what we should become. Our destiny is to become divine. We become that only in the measure we know ourselves. We know ourselves only through becoming ourselves. Our life is the field through which we discover who we are. Everything that happens to us in life is an occasion. Every single event, everything that happens to us is an occasion for us to know ourselves better. And the more we know of ourselves, the more power we have for expression in life. So consciousness and life are the inner and the outer part of the becoming towards a divine life. And then he comes to the most simple, self-evident statement. And I was wondering, why didn't he tell us this on page one? Why does he wait until more than 1,000 pages? Of course, he has told us earlier, but after 1,000 pages, does he really think he has to tell us this again? He says, in all spiritual life, the first essential is, anybody? First essential thing. Come on, we've read 1,000 pages. What's the first essential thing? First essential thing for spiritual life. Whatever is the goal of that spiritual life, the first essential thing is we have to go inside. Without going inside, without becoming conscious inside, without changing inside, there is no progress of life. Because life evolves by consciousness. So the key, how often do we remember that? If I have a company with employees, I'm constantly thinking, that man's not doing the right thing. I have to correct him. The politicians are the wrong politicians. Everything, whenever, from morning to night, I'm looking and seeing what's wrong with the world and how it needs to be fixed, whether it's in my household or my room or my machines need to be repaired or my family members have to change or the neighbors have to be different, or the police, or the government, or the world at large, or the Reserve Bank, or whatever it is, or the TVs must produce better entertainment, whatever it is. All our orientation is how the world should change. That was Darcy's attitude, no? He comes to the Meriton Ball, for whatever reason, we don't know, and then he stands there finding fault with everything. And everybody. And he's convinced his problem is not with himself. He's perfect. His problem is with the world around him.
Sir?
Yes.
Sir, from what you have narrated so far, if we take the story as analogy, it looks like until and unless Jane Austen decides Darcy will never know her existence. He will always be dependent on her to even have aspiration, curiosity, or even to go inside. So, if Darcy really wants to know his origin, that everything is Jane Austen, what are the right questions he needs to ask? It looks like until and unless Jane Austen decides, nothing can be achieved in the story. So how will Darcy become Jane Austen?
Darcy must discover he's Jane Austen. Darcy discovers that he's been selfish and proud and boorish and mean. He awakens to that fact. If he's waiting, supposing if you follow that logic, then Darcy says, after all, I'm only a character in the story. I am what I am because of Jane Austen. It's all her fault. Don't blame me. And there's nothing I can do about it. But what type of story is that? If Darcy realizes that he's Jane Austen, he will realize he can change himself and he can change the story. Darcy doesn't know, but if we think that God should change us, if we're waiting for God to rewrite the story, and after all, then we're just fatalists. Yes, this is what I am, this is how I was born, and there's nothing I can do about it, and if God wants me to be better, he better change me. That's not what Sri Aurobindo's saying. There are religions like that. What Sri Aurobindo's saying is, Darcy has to recognize that he has total power to become what he wants to become. That's what Krishna said. You can become whatever you believe you can become. And that's what happens to Darcy. Darcy foolishly calls her tolerable. He proposes to her in a very crude way. She says, you're the last man on earth I would ever marry. And what does he do? He doesn't say, well, that's what I am, and I'm a helpless, nothing I can do about it. That's not what he says. This is the girl I want to marry. She says, I'm the last man on earth, so I better change. And the value of the story and the value of Darcy is he decides he can change. And the value of all the characters who become more conscious. Lizzie, when she reads his letter, she says, I've been a fool. I've been absurd. I've been ignorant. I've been prejudiced. She decides to change. Mr. Bennett, when he sees the calamity of Lydia's elopement, he says, I've been very foolish. This is my own fault. I have nobody to blame. I must take the responsibility. I must change. All our progress comes only when we take what's coming from life and say, this comes to me to make me more conscious. And if I change my consciousness, my life will change. So again, I say, we read 1,000 pages of Life Divine to come to the first principle, which we all know. At least Mother has told us 1,000,000,000 times. Every change starts with ourselves. Every meaningful progress, the only meaningful progress is the progress that starts with ourselves. We have to go within. We have to go within to become more conscious. So it raises a practical question. What does it mean to go within? He says go within in every chapter. He's saying go within. What does it mean to go within? Anybody? Huh? Realizing our flaws. Raising to the expectation of the divine. What does it really mean? If this is the central message, if we don't get anything else out of the book, having read 1,070 pages by the time we, at least this we must be really clear about. Because he says, without doing this, you can't make a beginning. To get to life divine, we have to start from where we are. And where are we? Exactly. He spent 14 chapters, very politely, telling us where we are. We're in the ignorance. the sevenfold ignorance. He described in detail the ignorance that we're in. And he said the only way to come out of that ignorance is to start by going within. And what did you say? Repeat it again. Go from the ego to the psychic. It's the first step. Remember three transformations: the psychic transformation, spiritual transformation, supramental transformation. All three are necessary for the divine life. But we have to start from where we are. We're in the mind, we're on the surface, we're in the ego. And so the first step for us is we have to go within to try to find the psychic. And what does it mean? Why are we here? We are on the surface. We don't know ourselves. What we are conscious of is not the truth of our being. It's certainly not an infinite, eternal, self-existent reality. What are we conscious of? I'm conscious of my thoughts. I'm conscious of my beliefs. I'm conscious of my opinions. Like Darcy says, she's tolerable. Darcy thinks I'm very important. I'm a rich, important man, and she's a tolerable girl with whose nobody's dancing with. It's just on the surface. What else is on the surface? We have our feelings. We have our preferences. We have our attachments. We have our desires. We have our ambitions. We have our jealousies. We have Mrs. Bennett trying to triumph over Lady Lucas. We have Wickham weaving his falsehoods and his telling all the stories. We have Lydia running around following her impulses. We live on the mental, vital, physical surface, which is an egoistic consciousness where we feel separate from everybody else. And without moving away from that consciousness in the ignorance, there's no progress for us. There's certainly no divine life. It doesn't matter how much science and technology we get or how many democratic elections we have to try to get better government or whatever laws we pass or anything we do, we'll end up where we are as long as we're in the surface egoistic consciousness. What is it that keeps us on the surface? Why don't we get out of this? Why are we bound to it? Huh? Taste of ignorance. Okay, that's true. That's very philosophical. What does the ignorance taste like? Huh? Okay, what is it, that thing we enjoy? Selfishness. We do enjoy when everybody does and gives things to us. When everybody serves us, we enjoy it. When somebody suggests we should serve everybody else, that doesn't taste so good. What else keeps us on that selfishness? We think when mother says give up selfishness, oh, you want to rob me of everything I have. What she does want to rob us, she wants to rob us of our ignorance, of our suffering, of our pain, of our smallness, of our incapacity. She wants to take it away from us. She has to rob it because we guard it and cling to it. What else is there that keeps us on the surface?
Laziness.
Our possessiveness, our preferences, our desires, our ambitions. In Jane's case, her conformity. She wants everybody to like her. If she wants everybody to like her, she has to just be a mirror for what everybody else. She just has to be the perfect social model. Just on the surface, superficial. She has to have perfect manners. Perfect manners are fine, but you'll never become divine just by having perfect manners. So how do we move from the surface to the depth? Tell me one way.
By practice.
By practice. Practicing what? not lifting the barbells, I think. No. Practicing what? By how do we move from the surface to the depth? By consecration. Okay, great. Huh? You mean going for PhD and practicing values? Other man's point of view? All of these are helpful, but let's be very practical. Today, if I want to move from the surface to the depth, what should I do? Right now, what should I do? What should Darcy do as the first thing if he's at the, First thing Darcy should do is he should stop complaining about other people. Agreed? Darcy is sitting there quietly looking at everybody. He doesn't even know them. Oh, that lady is not well dressed, and this man is not very behaved, and these children are not cultured, and these people are having very much money. His whole life is judging other people and finding fault with them. He does it in a very serious way. Mr. Bennett does it in a very sarcastic way, cynical way. He's laughing at everybody as if he's so great. No? Mr. Bennett doesn't realize, Darcy doesn't realize, that by judging other people and finding fault with them, he's keeping himself in the ignorance. He's preventing himself from discovering his own truth. He's organizing his ignorance, and he's doing something that's even much more serious than that. What is he doing? Every time he has a complaint in his mind about another person, he's energizing the complaint. I had a very dramatic personal experience of this a few months ago. I took up a project to take off a project where somebody had created a big problem for themselves and for other people. And I got the assignment to fix up the problem and try to eliminate it and all. And the more I got into the problem, the more I found myself complaining in my mind about the person who had created the problem and finding fault with that person. And I felt very justified because I didn't create this problem at all. And this person has created so much of a problem for so many people. And I admit I felt a little proud because I'm cleaning up the problem that somebody else created, which is totally impermissible. But what I didn't realize for a long time is that every time I have the thought about where this person has done something wrong, the problem got worse. I have not spoken. I've not complained. I'm very self-denying. I'm not going to complain about the other person. Every time I think about where that person has done something wrong, should never have done this, unpardonable. You would do that if it's your child. I found the other person getting more and more angry with me as if I'm abusing him all the time. And more difficult and non-cooperative until nothing could be done. And one day I'm reading this chapter all this time, go within and all, what's going on here? Why is this going? Why has this come to me? I have no right to criticize anybody. I have no right to think for one moment that somebody else has made a mistake. If this problem has come for me, it's something I have to learn, and I had a great thing to learn. I have to give up judging any other person just the way Darcy does. Can we do it for 1 hour? Can we walk down the street and see the way people behave and see the way they dress? Can we go into a shop? Can we talk to people without judging? If they serve us food, can we eat the food with gratitude and not judge the way they have served it or the dishes they're using or the food they're using or how much they have given us or anything? Can we do it for a minute? As long as we cannot give up judging other people and criticizing them, we are on the surface. No question of going within. No question of raising our consciousness. And if we say we're going to consecrate And by consecrate, we consecrate the problem, and we consecrate everything that everybody did in each year. He made that mistake, and he made that mistake, and he made that mistake. What are we doing? We're energizing the problem. We're not raising our consciousness. And that's why Appa constantly says, the first thing you should do to solve a problem is stop energizing it. Even when we pray, Mother, solve my problem. I've got a serious problem. Please solve my problem. Mostly what we're doing is we're concentrating on the problem. When we consecrate the problem, we think, oh, I got this. I owe this much money to this man and that much money to this man. And this person is angry with me and that person is doing this. We're concentrating on the problem and energizing it. That's not consecration. I have often said hourly consecration means what? Remembering Mother on the hour, no? Offering ourselves to Mother every hour. It's not easy, you know, you have tried. But when we succeed, I have found when I succeed, mostly what I succeed is I remember the hour. Remembering on the hour that I'm supposed to remember Mother is more difficult. And consecrating to Mother, when I remember on the hour, I remember, yes, I have a problem, and therefore I'm remembering on the hour for Mother. I remember the problem on the hour, not Mother on the hour. The more I remember the problem, I'm putting the energy of my ignorance into the problem. That's not consecration. Consecration is you give the problem to Mother. If you really have consecrated the problem, you'll forget you had the problem. And it won't be there. Sri Aurobindo has an aphorism. He says that when the soul forgets its problem, it disappears. We do the opposite. And we think, Mother is not answering my prayer. Mother, I have consecrated for 3 days, and the problem is there. In spite of that, Mother comes. That's different. In spite of that, she solves the problem for us. But if we really have consecrated the problem, it can never come back again. It can never come back again. Because what has happened? We've gone from the surface to the depth. The surface is the problem. The surface is our ego, our ignorance. The depth is Mother. When we remember Mother, when we really remember Mother is there inside us, Mother is there all around us. With Mother there, how can there be a problem? There is no problem. Yes?
Sir, Ashokan sir has raised a question.
Good.
Jane decides on principle not to show any attraction for Bingley. Darcy's complaint is that Jane is not very demonstrative. In such a problematic situation, what is the ideal option for Jane?
So what does Jane believe in? Jane believes in maintaining a proper surface. Inside, she may be thinking so much of Bingley, actually she doesn't allow herself even to think. She just is there like a doll. Just like a doll, and waiting in the hope that Bingley will come to her. If Jane is a devotee, what should she do? She's on the surface, glued to the surface, just maintaining her surface behavior. And it look what happens, it takes her a year. Darcy was on the surface, he was very proud. Lizzie was on the surface, she was very prejudiced. Mr. Bennett was on the surface, he was very cynical and sarcastic. Mrs. Bennett was on the surface, she was pushing everybody around and scheming and trying to get what she wants. And none of them achieved when they were on the surface. They all achieved in the measure they gave up Darcy gave up his pride. Lizzie gave up her prejudice. Mr. Bennett became humble and accepted responsibility. And in that measure, he went from the surface to the depth. What does it mean to stop giving attention to a problem? You all have we have a great example in the Indian tradition about Krishna's friend, childhood friend, Kuchela. No? His wife's idea, he should go to Krishna. Krishna's a great prince and has everything and can give him something. And you go and ask Krishna, your childhood friend, for help, and he'll help you. And because he has nothing, she gives him a little puffed rice or something to give him. What happens? When he goes and sees Krishna and is warmly, affectionately received by Krishna, what happens? He completely forgets. He forgets he had a problem. He forgets even to give the offering. No, he forgets everything. And then only when he walks away and goes home, he realizes not his problem has been solved. His problem has been turned. Back in 1978, Appa wrote a paper. It's there on KYNet called Working Faith. He said, how do you really know when you have faith in mother? When a problem is there and you have faith in mother. He said, when you have referred the problem to mother, you feel the problem is solved. You no longer have the problem. Meaning, you go from the surface where you have problem, you go to the depth where mother, if mother is there, how can I have a problem? If mother, I've referred it to mother, I've given it to mother. When you feel that relief inside, the problem is no longer there. So in everything we do, the smallest thing, just looking at another person, we are on the surface. How do I move from the surface? When somebody says something and I disagree with it, I quarrel or I correct them. I tell them, what should I do? That's on the surface. I should move away from my own opinion. They have an opinion which I disagree with. Why does it come to me? Because I have an opinion. This comes not so I should correct somebody else's opinion. This comes so I should give up my opinion. Oh, let me drop it like a hotcake, like a disease. No opinions. I don't want any opinions. Can we go one day without reacting to something? Even when we're sitting quietly, even when we're in meditation, sometime I start thinking about something that somebody did, the way the driver drove or the way the cook did something. Can I say for 24 hours, I'm not going to react to anything that happens? I have found, I hope you have all seen, if you've not, you take the experiment today. You just take some situation or some person or something where you just feel it's an unpardonable situation for you, and you decide no reaction. Absolute, not expressing the reaction, no question of that. There should be no reaction. And you see what happens. You see what happens to that problem. Because reaction keeps the surface. Reaction keeps us in the problem. Reaction energizes the problem. Reaction keeps us in the ignorance. It keeps us in the ego. So the first thing we should do is drop it. Nobody wants to collect disease and carry it around with us. It's a disease. It's a cancer. Get rid of all reaction like you want to get rid of any disease quickly. You know, enough. I don't want any more of this. How long should you take to give up a disease? Just get rid of it, because it only aggravates your problems and keeps you in the ignorance and prevents us from going inside. Now, giving up complaints and giving up reactions and giving up judgments is not discovering the soul. What we are doing is actively the opposite. Where the soul is in that direction, we are going in the other direction. So the first step, which Appa has been asking us to take, is if you want to get to the soul, stop going in the wrong direction. Even if you're not going to go in the right direction, at least stop going in the wrong direction. To say I didn't complain today and I didn't react today is not spirituality. It's just like saying I didn't steal anything today. I didn't kill anybody today. I didn't steal anything today. I didn't crash my car today. That's not spirituality. Yeah? We're not supposed to steal. We're not supposed to lie. We're not supposed to kill. We're not supposed to create accidents. We're not supposed to throw things. We don't become yogis or saints or supermen because we don't do those things. But without stopping those things, how can we make the progress? How can we go to the inside to discover the truth of our being? So Appa's first principle for anything is start from where we are. And starting from where we are is, it's a long list. Sri Aurobindo gives those 27 things in the mother. Stop judging, stop complaining, stop criticizing. Then he says, if you want to go beyond that, stop asking for what you want. He calls it silent will. When I want something and I don't ask for it, I don't become a saint or a yogi. Because though I have not asked for it, I still want it. That's not consecration. That doesn't elevate us to a great height. But Appa says practically, if you observe, you all know, you've read it, and maybe hopefully you tried it, you all know, when you don't ask for things, you get more. But the goal is not to get more. The goal is to get to the truth. The goal is to get to the soul. The goal is to get mother and the divine. The goal is not, here's a trick where you can get more by not asking. Not asking is a step towards, qualifies us to make a spiritual progress, but not asking is not consecration. What is consecration? What's the difference between not asking for something and consecrating it? I would put it even more than that. That's a halfway there. Accepting is giving it to the divine. I want something for myself. Okay, I won't ask. Whatever I want, let me give the want to mother. Let me give the thing and the want to mother. Not asking or and accepting what comes is better than quietly or asking or quietly wishing for it or praying for it. I agree. But what really, that's not consecration. Consecration is to give yourself to mother. To say, what I want is not this or that or anything. I want you, mother. So I give up my desires, I give up my aspirations, I give up my complaints, I give up my irritation, I give up my self-importance, I give up my pride, I give it to you, I want you. In the Vedas, in the Veda, Sri Aurobindo is written, the going inside means you create the sacrificial fire, Agni, in your heart. It's your aspiration to the divine. And you pour all the impurities of your being onto that. You put it in the fire and let it burn. Mother says the same thing. Create the inner fire and put everything on the fire. Okay, we have come to mother because we had a problem and she solves our problems. It's true, perfectly true. We found if we pray to mother, she grants what we want. It's perfectly true. If we do 3-day calling, our problems are solved or we get something. But is that the end? Is that all? There's a line in Savitri where the voice speaks to Savitri and says, remember why thou camest. Find out thy soul. In silence, seek God's meaning in thy depth, then mortal nature changed to the divine. These four lines is the last chapter of Life Divine, which he's expanded and discussed in detail as we are doing. Solving our problems is great. We have Mother to do that. She gives us prosperity. She gives us happiness. She gives us long life and health and so many things. But that's not really why we've come. That's not really why Mother came. Mother didn't come to solve everybody's problems. And those devotees who were lucky enough to come to Mother, if you only get your problem solved, it's like buying a bunch of bananas and getting only the peel. If you take the peel of the banana and think you got the value, you see, I got a good price on these bananas and I got so many banana peels. We have not got what Mother wants to offer us. We have not known what Mother is. We have not, oh yes, Mother's very powerful. She gets me all the chocolate I want, or she gets me the money I want, or something else. We have missed the fact. It's good. She gives us these things. But if that's all we get, we got only the banana peel. And we don't need chapter 56 to tell us. If we're satisfied with that, then it's for the next life. So he says, go within. How else can we go from the surface? There are many ways to go from the surface to the depth. One of the difficult ways is to give up our rights and our claims. It's one thing, I don't ask for something. Now you're saying, give up what's your right and your claim. Chandrasekhar has written a beautiful story. I don't know how many of you have read it yet or it's published yet. He'll tell when he speaks. But beautiful story about this girl who practices this, giving up. If he hasn't, he can tell the story to you. It's worth the listening. It's so wonderful. And what happens when she gives up her claims? Appa, 45 years ago, when he had this project, when Beautyland came to him, it was a partnership with another man and Mother, and the other man who had given money. Appa had done all the work, and Appa found out the other man wants to take the project. He found out the project's become so profitable, so valuable, that he wanted to take the whole project for himself. So he told Appa, I don't want the project anymore. You buy my part. You pay me back the money I put in and you keep the project, knowing fully well that Appa could not do that. Because that man put the money, Appa did develop the project. He knew it. So Appa understood his mind and he said, I cannot pay you the money. If you don't want to do the project with me, you take the project. Appa didn't even ask. You pay me for all the work I have done and for raising the value of the project. From the 2 lakhs the man had invested to being worth 8 or 10 lakhs, you pay me my share of that and you take the project. Appa didn't ask for anything. All right, if you want the project, you take it. The man said, that's a good idea. This is a good idea. Mother would appreciate this. You're very sincere. Mother would appreciate this. Mother did appreciate it. When the man went to Mother and started talking about his plans for the project, Mother said, what about Appa? No, he's no longer in the project. I am doing the project. Mother said, no, it's his project. You give it to him. That's the story. When we give up our claim, when we give up all our claims, the right thing, the best thing comes to us. In the story of Dr. Thorne,
thank you,
which I think some of you know, Mary Thorne is an illegitimate child her mother has left her. Dr. Thorne has taken her as his as an uncle and raised her wonderfully. She's a wonderful girl with a wonderful personality. Everybody loves her. She has no money. Frank Gresham, who's the son of the squire, the very wealthy people, has fallen in love with Mary, knows her since childhood, and really wants to marry her. But Frank's father has gotten in deep in debt, and therefore the parents say that Frank has to marry a rich girl in order to, otherwise the property will be lost and everything will be lost. Frank says, no, I want to marry Mary. Mary knows that his family won't approve of the marriage, even though Frank's father loves Mary like a daughter. But no, Frank must marry a rich girl, otherwise the family will lose its property, and it's a hundreds of years old estate. So Mary knows the parents won't approve. So when Frank comes and proposes to her, she keeps quiet. She refuses to accept. But she can't say no. She can't say she does. She loves him. She has loved him from childhood. So finally, Frank's mother, Lady Arabella, comes and tells Mary that you are running after Frank, so I don't want you to see my son again, so don't come to our house. She used to grow up in their house. So she didn't come to the house. Then Frank is coming on holiday from the college, so they send Mary away, so she's not there, so Frank can't. Mary accepts. Mary accepts all of this. Frank goes away for 1 year on promising his father, because to hope that he'll forget Mary, and when he comes back, the first thing he does is go to Mary and propose to her. Again, third time. She keeps quiet. He says, tell me you don't love me. Tell me you don't love me and I will leave you alone. Tell me you don't love me. Do you refuse to take my hand? He just holds out his hand right next to her. If you tell me you can't take my hand, that you don't want to marry me. Finally, she moves one finger, and he grabs her hand and says, now we are engaged, now it's final. Now his parents don't know what to do. So finally, Lady Arabella comes to Mary and says, I asked you to stay away from Frank, you did it, but my son is uncontrollable. You say that you're engaged to him, and she says, you give up the engagement. Mary says, I can't give up the engagement. I have promised him. He asked for my promise. I have given it. I cannot break my promise. No, don't you see it's very selfish of you? Because if you marry Frank, you will ruin him. She says, if Frank wants to be released from his promise, I will release him. Lady Arabella, kind of like King Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana, they give this very strange argument in their favor. She says, you see, if Frank asks you to release him, everybody will condemn him for breaking his promise. He will never do it. You should break it. You should tell Frank you won't marry him. Because do you want to be the source of Frank losing the property and impoverishing? Do you want to ruin Frank's life? You say you love him. If he marries you, you'll ruin his life. If you really love him, you won't do that. It's a perverse logic, like Dhritarashtra saying, I won't give you anything and you shouldn't ask for anything, even one village. So finally, Mary says, yes, Lady Arabella may be mean and false and everything, but it's true. I think Frank will be ruined if he marries me. So she writes a letter to Frank that saying that she feels that she can't marry him because it will ruin him, and therefore she's calling off the engagement. She mails the letter to Frank. The next morning, her uncle, Dr. Thorne, is called to a patient. It happens to be, for those of you who remember any of the story, Roger's son, Louis, who's the heir to Roger's huge fortune. And Dr. Thorne finds out that Louis has died during the night. And Dr. Thorne knows that the heir to Roger's wealth is Mary, who never knew, nobody knew. The only one who knew that if Louis dies, Mary will be the heir. And all the debts of Frank's family are only owed to Mary now. And that's a small part of her wealth. And after the thing is confirmed and Dr. Thorne tells Frank's father and Frank, Frank says, how can I hold her to a promise now? She's so fabulously rich. It's not fair. The point is, when she gave up everything for her love of him, for her real love of him, she not only got Frank, she wiped out the debts of the whole family which had been accumulated, and she brought three times more wealth to the family. That's going within. That's what Appa did when this man wanted to take the property. So there are so many ways we can go from the surface to the depth. We can do it at every minute. We can do it at every hour. We can do it in everything we do. And that is his first message. Yes?
Sir, there is a similar situation in Pride and Prejudice also. Lady Catherine de Bourgh abuses Elizabeth in the same way. What would have happened if Elizabeth sees some truth in the point that she will also ruin Darcy by her relatives and her connections? If her reaction was the like Mary, she understood that there is some truth in what Lady Catherine de Bourgh says.
In fact, it's a good question. The story, it's a parallel. It's not an exact situation. Here, Frank, remember, Mary never asked Frank anything. Frank insisted on getting engaged to her, and she finally gave in to his insistence. She never made a claim on her own. And she was willing to give up that claim if Frank wants it. Mary, Lady Arabella is asking her not to be willing to give it up. He's asking her to give it up without Frank wanting it, even if Frank doesn't want it. In this case, Elizabeth has not been offered anything. Darcy has not proposed to her again. Darcy's not come back to her. She's not been offered something that she should give up. What she refused, what Lady Catherine asked her to give up, promise me you will not get engaged to him. Meaning, not that you won't go and ask him. If he comes and asks you to marry him, promise me you won't. That's a... On what basis should she do that? Elizabeth marrying Darcy is not going to ruin Darcy. Rather, it's going to give him life. Because Elizabeth has what Darcy lacks. Darcy's dead. He's wooden. He has money. He has position, but he has no life. He has no emotions. Elizabeth's full of life and vitality. That's why he's so attracted to her. She's not hurting Darcy by accepting marriage if he should give it. But at that point, she doesn't think there's any chance that Darcy's going to propose to her. In fact, when Lady Catherine says, if you won't agree, I'm going to London and I will tell Darcy, she's convinced that Darcy will never come and never propose. It's a slightly different situation. Your question is good. I will think about it more. But what Lizzie refuses to do is simply give it up to, it's a false position that Lady Catherine is asking her. Nobody has a right to ask such a thing. She's not doing a help. The only person she'd be helping there is helping Lady Catherine. But let's follow the logic for a minute, and supposing that she does it. Well, in fact, we have a parallel situation. We don't have to use that. A clearer example of this, exactly what happened. In Framley Parsonage, I think Appa has written about the story about Mark Lufton and his sister Lucy. In fact, I wanted to talk them about the other part of the story, but this is an exact parallel to what you're asking. Mark Lufton is a clergyman who has a living in the area and the property of Lady Lufton, who's a very wealthy aristocrat. Her son is Lord Lufton, who's a friend of Mark, and he's got a living of about £1,000, which is £800,000, a very wealthy position, good position he's gotten. Their parents are dead, and Lucy is his sister, young sister. Lord Lufton falls in love with Lucy. Lady Lufton's a very affectionate, good mother, but she wants Lord Lufton to marry an aristocrat. And Lord Lufton comes and proposes to Lucy. And Lucy says, I won't marry you unless your mother asks me, which is impossible. It's like imagining Mrs. Bennet is going to go and ask Bingley to marry Charlotte. There's no question of something like that. Lady Lufton's she says, I don't want to come between you and your mother. I don't want to spoil the affectionate relationship you have between you and your mother. Your mother's been very good to my brother and very good to me. So she refuses. What happens? Lord Lufton, it's a long story, but finally he goes away for a year and comes back, and he finally says, Mother, I cannot be happy with any other girl. You want to make me miserable? Finally, Lady Lufton comes to the place where Lucy is, calls Lucy out, and says, please become my daughter-in-law. That's the same principle here. That's a closer parallel. This story also, in fact, this was the first story when I read it, I showed to Appa. He liked it so much. From there, we went to Pride and Prejudice, because the life response that I told him was not this one, which was very striking, how Lucy got what she wanted. The real heart of the story is about Lucy's brother, Mark. He's a clergyman who at a young age has been given everything he could ask in life. He's got a very good living. He's got close friends with the aristocracy. He's got status. But he has ambition. He wants to rise even further. He wants to rise and mix with the most important people, just for the vanity and importance of it. So he disobeys the wishes of Lady Lufton and starts keeping company with other people who she disapproves of. And through a long story, he gets deep in debt. He doesn't spend money, he lends money, and he gets deep in debt because out of vanity, he wants to please people so he can become important. And he gets deep in debt and he suffers through this. And the money lenders come after him and he's not gotten any money. He's not gambled anything. He's not bought anything. He's not spent anything. He simply promised to endorse somebody else's debt and help him. He was lied to and he believed it and he got in deep trouble. And this goes on for a year and it's torturing him. You have to remember that he's a clergyman. The only thing the clergyman has is his reputation. He's supposed to be teaching people about God. So he must be very godly, and a man who gets deep in debt and is going to go to debtor's prison he loses all the prestige that he got in life. He loses all the prestige. So finally, the court sends the bailiffs to physically take his property. Go to his house and take all the furniture and everything in his house. Lord Lufton is his friend, and he knows if he really begs Lord, if he tells Lord Lufton, nobody knows about his problem. In fact, he comes home one day and he has to confess to his wife. For 1 year, his wife never knew about this problem. And finally, he has to tell her that he's bankrupt and the police are coming, the court officials are coming to confiscate everything in their house. It's the worst humiliation for him in the world. And so he tells his wife, he confesses to her what he has done and how he has ruined the family. And he stands away from her. They're standing in the kitchen. He stands away from her. And she says to him, her name is Fanny. Fanny says to him, "Why are you keeping me at a distance?" He says, "I have done something so terribly wrong, I have ruined the family." She said, "I'm your wife. At the time when things are worst, I must be closest to you. You shouldn't keep me away." And she goes and insists on him embracing him. So true she is. Then the court officials are coming, and he goes out to meet the court officials, and he says, "You can take everything because I can't pay you." And just at that time, Lord Lufton comes and finds out about it. He didn't know anything about it. And he sends the court officials away, and he says, "I will pay the money today itself." And the next day, Lady Lufton accepts Lucy. And so Mark is not only saved from disaster and humiliation, Mark's younger sister becomes the future Lady Lufton. Mark is no longer a friend, he's a member of the family. He rises in that way. Both of them did the same thing. He said, "I have done the wrong thing. I have been foolish. I am not going to borrow more money. I'm going to take responsibility for what I have done." In other words, instead of trying to solve the problem outside, he goes in and accepts, "This was my falsehood. This was my mistake." That's what Mr. Bennett does, no? When he says, "I must repay Gardner." Same thing. He moves from the surface to the depth. When he moves from the surface to the depth, not only doesn't he have to pay Gardner, but three girls are married. And who are they married to? And what is the prosperity that comes in the family? So this principle is there all around us all the time. And if you think about all the experiences you've had and all the other devotees have had, we know this is true. This is the step, the first step in the movement from our life in the ignorance, our life in the in suffering, our life in on the surface. The first step to the divine life is to go from the surface to the depth, to go inside. And in this chapter, he traces all the steps of going inside until we reach the psychic, and why that opens up and why that leads to a divine life and other steps in the process, because that's only the first step. But when we're reading the chapter and discussing it, it's very hard to go beyond. This is so important. I've not gone beyond the first step. I'm still complaining. I'm still judging. I'm still reacting. I'm still asking for things. I'm still trying to solve my problems outside instead of inside. I'm still remembering the hour instead of mother. I'm still asking mother to solve my problems rather than give myself to mother and really consecrate my life to her. I'm still thinking of what I want and not remembering why my soul came.
What is the real idea behind giving up? I just learned that whatever I ask mother, she will grant it. Then why should I give up anything? And whatever I'm giving up, what if that is the thing and I'm actually giving it up? And even if I give it up, I now will have an expectation that it will come back. It, something will come back more in bigger magnitude. So I am giving it up.
It's a wonderful question which everybody can agree with and identify with. Why should I give up? You don't have to give up anything. You can ask mother to fulfill all the things you want. But after you get everything you want, we will still be in the same life. See, after all, if you compare our life today with the, if you compare your life with the life that your parents had when they were growing up, or what the life was in India 50 years ago, we already have everything. Nobody had education then, nobody had car, nobody had air conditioning, nobody had foreign travel, nobody had all the things that we have today. Has our life become divine? You should give up only when you want something more. As long as what we want are cars and houses and Saudis and more sweets and other things like that, don't give it up. Pray for it and pray that we outgrow it. Appa has never, that's what I appreciated so much about Appa, because in writing these books, when the first time I said, you're asking everybody to pray for all of these things, because he understood we can only start from where we are. Appa has never written, I think you'll tell me, you all read his books more than I have. He's never written saying, don't ask for something you want. He's never written that. He's never said it's wrong. I don't say it's wrong. Sri Aurobindo doesn't say it's wrong. He only says, as long as that's all you want, that's all you're going to get. How many cars do you want? How many houses do you want? How many clothes do you want? How much of jewels do you want? You can have it. Is that all you want? Is that, that's not going to make your life divine. Appa doesn't say you have to give up all those things. You have to give up thinking that that's all there is. Sri Aurobindo doesn't say a life divine is a life without cars or houses or jewels or food or saris or anything. He doesn't say that. It's a life of prosperity. It's a life of abundance. But as long as that's all we want, as long as that's what we keep praying for, that's all we're going to get. What about joy? What about love? What about harmony? What about spiritual experience? There's something beyond this. So Appa, in writing his first story, shows rightly. Nobody else has done it. He so rightly. Mother will give you what you want. But the why should he write books? Mother didn't come to give everybody what they want. Appa understood when mother gives you everything you want, the gain is you will discover that mother is more valuable than any of the things you have. If you have Kamadhenu, then you don't need to ask for everything, no? Because whatever you want, she'll give. She's more important than that. And then you have to ask, is this what I need? Do I need more of this, or is there something else I can give? And if I want something more, the first thing I have to do is not give up the things. I have to give up thinking that those things are the most important things
for me.
See, what does Darcy give up? Darcy doesn't give up his money. Darcy doesn't give up his property. Darcy doesn't give up his social position. At the beginning of the story, Darcy thinks that what he has is very valuable and important, so valuable and important that he can't even mix with these people or talk to them, so valuable and important that when he asks Lizzie to marry him, she will immediately agree, which he's shocked when she refuses. What happens? When she says, "You're the last man on earth I would marry," he discovers for the first time that there's something more valuable to him than his prestige, than his self-importance, than his property. His progress comes because he understands by giving up his pride, he gets something worth infinitely more than his self-importance. He gives up his self-importance, he gives up his arrogance, he gives up his selfishness to get emotional fulfillment which he never dreamed of. Which was not there in his life, which is not there in the life of Lady Catherine or the aristocracy. So, I'll summarize my answer is, nothing wrong with asking for anything, but be careful what you ask for. Because what you ask for will determine what you get. And I think there are lots of stories in India and elsewhere about when you have to be careful of what you ask for. The best thing to ask for, when we ask out of our ignorance. Do we really know what's good for us? See, Collins really thinks he should marry Lizzie. So if Collins is a mother's devotee, he's going to pray and pray and pray, let Lizzie marry me. That would have been a life of misery. Mrs. Bennett, her whole problem is she really wanted Lizzie to marry Collins. So according to your question, Sweta, Lady Catherine, if she's a mother's devotee, will be praying morning, noon, and night, "Mother, you must make Lizzie marry Collins." What would she have gotten? Apart from the fact that there would have been an instant divorce and there'd be no peace of mind. Lizzie would never talk to her mother again. She would have missed Pemberley. When we know we're in the ignorance, when we know we're in the ego, when we know we don't know what's right for us and best for us, the best thing to do is, "Mother, your will be done, not my will." I'm in the ignorance, I'm on the ego, I have desires, I have ambitions, I have attachments, I have prejudices, I have reactions. Let me not ask for what I want, let me ask for what you want. Why ask for what mother wants? Why not ask for mother? Why ask for a little thing? If you have mother, you have everything. If you have mother, you don't need anything. If you have mother, everything is granted. You cannot have a want. So why take a little thing? When that's the story of life divine. You can have everything, but then that's what you should want. You should want the truth. Darcy wanted people who will compliment him and flatter him. He didn't ask for the truth. He said he wants people to look up to him and think he's important. But what really will make Darcy happy is the truth. He discovered that truth, at least partially, painfully, after he proposed to Lizzie. So be sure you ask for the best possible thing. Asking for mother to be your life, to be the center of your life, to give you what she wants to give you, or rather to give you herself, which is better than anything she can give, everything else comes up. Very good question.